Science Unscripted.
Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
We are going to start off with an email, two emails. One that's a little longer and one that's shorter. Gabe, I have them both right here. I don't even know if you've read these.
I don't read emails anymore.
One of your New Year's resolutions. I'll see you in the unemployment line. Emails.
Just get to the
okay.
Email.
In the early 1950s, real quick, a preface. We talked last week about the idea of contagious urination, that if someone else is peeing or another animal is peeing, it is more likely that I'm going to start peeing, urinating, and that this was established.
Chimpanzees, right?
Yeah, by observing 600 hours of chimpanzee videotape from a sanctuary in Japan. In the early 1950s, back to the email now, my family visited some relatives in Regina, Saskatchewan, so in Canada. I have very few memories of that trip, but one which has stayed is of the milk delivery that my aunt was receiving. The milk wagon was pulled by a team of two horses that were so alike that they may have been brothers. And when the milkman was carrying his tray of bottles to the house, one horse began to pee. I was amazed at the volume he produced. But more amazing was that his teammate began to pee a similar amount when the first horse's pee hit the pavement. And that's the end of a beautiful email from Murray. Murray, thank you for sending that.
His teammate?
I mean, what a beautiful image. What a beautiful scene. I know it's the 1950s, but having milk delivered, I've always wanted milk to be delivered that way again. I want that to come back.
I can see a sepia tone on this memory. I'm looking at it. I'm looking through memory Murray's memories, mm-hmm. and looking back into the past and watching science happen.
Well, yeah.
What was the science of it that the chimpanzees, based on how close they were to each other, if one of their teammates started peeing, then they would. Yeah. Automatically do it, or was more likely that they would do it, or
more likely and statistically significantly up to a range of 3 meters. If you were 3 meters or more away from the other chimpanzee, you probably were not going to urinate when they began urinating. Mm-hmm. As you got closer and closer, the chances went up. If that was a socially dominant chimpanzee, the chances also went up in the hierarchy of chimpanzees, which I think, again, that's what we discussed at the end of the show, was sort of reflected in the way humans go to the bathroom, like at a bar or in a social setting. Are you going to the bathroom? Yeah, I'll go too. We do kind of do that. That's what's one interesting fact about that. Also, Murray, I'm with you on the volume. Anyone who's seen a horse urinate, there's a reason we say in English to pee like a racehorse. It goes very quickly. There's a lot of liquid coming out. Last email, it was more of a sentence, commenting on how apparently toward the end of our chat, one of us must have been saying your analysis, but it sounded like your analysis. This was Nancy's observation, your analysis. And that's what that whole thing was. It was a your analysis, but not in a...
Of urine.
Not medicinal or looking at the chemicals.
Or the practice of urination.
Looking at the social aspect of urinating when it comes to... the animal kingdom and ourselves. I'm going to stick there just for a second because, Gabe, one thing we didn't have a chance to talk about last week, which I thought was one of the most interesting aspects of this whole primate discussion. One of the studies was about baboons, which is a primate that I'm not very fond of, and how they cannot recognize themselves in the mirror, and how this was established. It was established by shining either a red or a green laser onto them. And first without the mirror, first just onto the hand, and they're like, what is that? And they're trying to hit it away. Then on a part of their body they can't see, and then they look in the mirror, and they see that dot on themselves, and they don't brush it off, indicating that they don't recognize that baboon in the mirror is me.
Yeah.
I kind of referenced really briefly that there are quite a few other animals who can do it, and it's interesting how they establish that and also where it fails. I'll start with gorillas, one of the great apes, one of the primates that can do this. It was tough for scientists to actually establish that because if you put a mirror in front of a gorilla, gorillas don't tend to look each other in the eyes immediately. That could be seen as a threat. And so if the first impression is like, oh man, there's another gorilla looking right at me, a gorilla will immediately look away or possibly initially look away, making it harder to establish, do they recognize themselves in the mirror and do they see a dot A lot of times you use stickers, like placed on the shoulder or something where they can't see. Right. So gorillas can do it, but that was a challenge for them to establish. The other direction, sort of, with Asian elephants, that's because they would see things on themselves and not care. They might have a sticker.
Just because they're not reacting to it doesn't mean necessarily that they can't see or understand their reflection. It's just that maybe it doesn't matter to them.
They don't groom. So we do. We groom. Right? Whereas elephants...
Well, some of us, groom. Yeah.
You don't... Yeah, you're not as much...
I'm not a groomer.
Well, that word has a horrible connotation now. You mean you don't pay attention to your I don't know, facial hair and hair. And also just to add some of the other... I thought it was an interesting list of animals that have been established to be able to do this. Orcas seem to be able to do it. They look at it. If you've got a sticker on themselves, they look at it in the mirror. Dolphins open their mouths and look inside their mouths when there's a mirror present. I think humans do that too. Ants, surprisingly, on the list.
Oh, wow.
Ants move differently. They do a kind of wobble back and forth when they're looking at themselves in the mirror. I think that was the biggest surprise for me. But a lot of animals out there have this sense of self. They're aware of the fact that I am different from everyone else and everything else that's happening here. That's a strange feeling. To know that they're aware of that. It means they're a lot more like us.
Are you aware that eggs are apparently very healthy for us?
Oh, I thought you were going to say very expensive.
I'll get to that in a second. But first, the healthiness. There was a study done in Australia based on Australian and American data. So they had 8,756 Australian and American adults age 70 plus. Take part in a longitudinal study. So they were...
All of them were age 70 plus.
They were all at least 70. And every 6 years they checked in on these people. It's part of a different data set, but they were able to use this study to see how healthy eggs are with regard to cardiovascular health. So if these people ate eggs regularly, and this was per week between 1 and 6 eggs, so almost up to 1 egg a day, mm-hmm. it was... 29%, the likelihood that of cardiovascular death, so death based on CDV or cardiovascular disease, went down by 29%.
Almost 30% lower if...
17% all mortality, 29% cardiovascular related.
Well, that all mortality is almost... I'll take that.
That's huge as well.
Yeah.
And it regardless of high cholesterol, so it irrespective of cholesterol levels, if you ate eggs, 1 to 6 eggs per week, that huge of a difference. Because if you had high cholesterol, it went down to 27% instead of 29%, which is essentially a wash. Incredible. Because that, my whole life, I've heard my mom, I love eggs. I've always loved eggs. And my mom said, you can't eat eggs more than twice a week.
Yeah, yeah.
Because of the cholesterol. You can't do it, Gaby. It's one of the few tips my mom gave me.
Well, that was prevailing wisdom. In fact,
yes.
I would say it is still prevailing wisdom until you read a study like this one.
Germany's Robert Koch Institute, the CDC, the FDA, all of them say watch consumption of eggs, never more than 1 a day. Germany says 3 a week, 3 eggs per week because of the cholesterol levels. According to this research out of Monash University in Australia, not necessarily the case. Mm-hmm. So 1 to 6 eggs per week brings mortality with regard to cardiovascular disease down 29%.
And I'm still stuck on what to me is the far more significant finding, the 17% all mortality, because if it reduces cardiovascular mortality by 30%, I jump to the thought, well, yeah, but maybe you're dying in a different way. Mm-hmm. Maybe it has this one positive effect and other negatives. It does not appear to be that way if... Yeah.
That was the finding. There's all kinds of other egg information that I can give you. I got 3 different papers here if you want me to keep going.
Are you working for the egg industry? Are you being financed?
1.5 trillion eggs per year consumed or produced around the globe, which means on average 150 eggs per person per year.
And probably a decent
almost every other day?
Yeah, a decent amount of them probably chucked out or never make it to market or expire.
If those are all eaten.
Yeah.
Yeah. The FDA says, like I said, that you shouldn't go above an egg per day.
Yeah. Two of the reasons we're talking about this now is it is obviously connected to egg prices rising.
Yes.
Specific to the U.S.?
70% increase in the price of wholesale eggs. So a dozen eggs right now in the United States cost $4.15. That's up 70% compared to 1 year ago.
Because of avian flu or bird cullings?
Yeah, so over the past year, inflation would have led to an increase of 2.5%. It's not 70%. The main reason why that increase has happened is because since October, 14 million hens have been culled, which is, I think, 5% fewer eggs on the market, leading to that soar in prices. And according to the latest estimate, it's going to continue to rise. So it's going to be another 20% on top of that 70%. So eggs are expensive and maybe not even existent, not on the shelves anymore. Where they are, the prices are going up, and it looks like there's no end in sight for that, at least for the next year.
I saw a question posed, and I do not know the answer to it. It is whether eggs, if you had a hen infected with avian flu, with H5N1, could I get avian flu?
How are you consuming that egg? Are you drinking it raw like Rocky?
Oh.
Then maybe. But if you are cooking it, if it gets to 160 degrees Fahrenheit... 160 degrees Fahrenheit, there is no way that you can get avian flu because it neutralizes the virus. Most people cook eggs. I would absolutely recommend that you cook eggs, not only because of avian flu, and also the likelihood of you getting avian flu is extremely low, but also because of salmonella.
That's what I was going to say, yeah.
You know,
every time I cook eggs or crack them open, I immediately wash my hands with soap afterwards. It's the why contract salmonella when it's as easy as washing your hands with soap?
Especially if eggs now are so expensive, why would you pay a lot of money to get horrible diarrhea?
I was going to say a dozen eggs. It's hard for me to undo that. In Germany, you tend to buy packs of 10. They're not 12, they're 10.
Yeah.
And I picked them up yesterday, and they were free range, not organic, but free range, and they were €2.89. That's what they cost here in Germany. Just as a cross comparison that I'll throw in there at the end.
So come on over to Germany, everyone listening to this right now.
Yeah, let's have an egg buffet. Let's have an omelet together.
It might keep you alive.
Quick final update here it's on artificial intelligence. I'm not sure everyone listening uses artificial intelligence. I find personally it is creeping into my life after an initial excitement phase. Whoa, it's here. Look at what. And then I stopped. And now it's creeping in. Mostly for me personally, through the use of Bing Copilot. It's a Microsoft product in combination with ChatGPT from OpenAI.
Instead of searching on a standard internet search, you go to
I will tell you what I do.
What do you do?
Yeah, my favorite use of it. I don't tend to use it that way. If I'm cross comparing various PDFs, for example, that's something that I would throw into an AI tool. What I love doing, going back to the eggs, is I am the proud owner of a German product called, it's a cooking product called a Thermomix. I got a used one for Christmas.
Yeah.
And a cookbook with it. It's an actual book. And what I do is if I want to make that recipe, I photograph it with my phone, copy the text, because your phone can do that now, from a picture. It can read the information, copy and paste that into any AI software, and I say, can you please take all of these various ingredients and group them by the part of the grocery store I would buy them in? And it does that.
Wow.
All of this in like 30 seconds.
And that applies to German grocery stores? You know exactly where to go?
Yeah. I mean,
because I found German grocery stores are really hard to navigate.
They're all very different from one
another.
I never
know where I'm looking for.
Yeah. Anything. It makes you end up going to the one that you know most of the time, right? Because you know exactly where the stuff is. Anyway, it's creeping into all of our lives. And a couple of news stories just to kind of update everyone on some of the big moves. I think most of you have heard of DeepSeek. This is the Chinese quote unquote competitor to ChatGPT and other large language models that made headlines because it was done on the cheap, because it was so cheap.
And uses less energy, is that right?
In the initial training, yes. I think what most people are focusing on are the number of GPUs. These are the processors, really expensive. I think the biggest company most of you will have heard of is NVIDIA, but AMD, Intel, others make these chips. And to create a large language model, the idea was, wow, I need anywhere from 50,000 and more of these chips. And they're in the multiple thousands of dollars, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars or euros just to buy one. They're really expensive.
Running simultaneously to run an LLM.
Yeah, I believe the most extensive use of them or the most intensive is the training period. But yeah, you're using these chips. You're using a lot of energy to run them. That's another expensive part of it. But the idea before DeepSeek came along was that if you're going to build AI, you need multiple billions of euros. And that has been upended, hence drops in the stock in stock markets or in those tech stocks around the world. All of this kind of goes back to something we talked about this on the show a while ago. It was Meta, Facebook and Meta deciding to create a large language model and make it transparent, open it to anyone. That information has helped DeepSeek to become what it now is. I believe it's also doing the same thing. And the bigger message for everyone out there is it was a weird news story because it was framed negatively. And there are problems with this large language model. If you're searching for political information or historical information about China, some of that is blocked. You will not get the answer that you seek. And that because it is quote unquote politically sensitive, you need to be aware of that. But I think it's actually a net positive for most everyone out there. We no longer have a situation where the super companies in Silicon Valley are in charge of everything that's happening in the AI field. It is being quote unquote democratized. You're going to have a lot more language models to work with in the future. Other quick update, one of the companies I just mentioned, ChatGPT, or rather OpenAI, two new products. One of them is Deep Research, and I'm just going to focus on that one because I've been toying around with it. We're shifting from large language models to something called agents, and agents scour the web very differently and do different things than a large language model. So a large language model, if I had to ask it a question,
predicts text, right?
Yeah, it's predicting text based on what it knows. The best description, and it's not a technical one, goes back to this guy. I've been following him for a long time now. He's a Wharton professor who researches AI. His name's Ethan Mollick, and he took a look at it and said, look, it's OpenAI, this new tool, Deep Research, is more like engaging an opinionated, almost PhD-level researcher who follows a lead. So whereas before, Gabe, if you had said, like, I don't know, I want new skis, then the old large language models would have looked for which websites have published an article like that. Maybe they merge them a little, but that would be the end. This Deep Research is like, it's almost like hiring a person to do the research for you. It'll come back and ask you questions about how large are you, what size do you need. It'll find, you know, compare a couple of different skis, for example, and then ultimately hone in on that one that really, based on what you've prompted it with, knows what to do. So
a more sophisticated way to search through the World Wide Web.
Agent is kind of a clunky name, but it's like setting a human loose to go do things. They can go and interact with things and then rephrase the question again. In certain cases, I don't know how this works subscription-wise, but could, for example, theoretically go into an app. An app is a closed system and has access to certain data that isn't publicly available on the web, but it could theoretically do that. And that's how this is shifting now.
Yeah. And that's ChatGPT or OpenAI?
That one is OpenAI. Yeah. And final thing I'll say here, because these tools are cropping up at such a rate and the developments, it's really hard to keep track of. And for any of you still listening, do you care about AI? It's sort of the biggest thing happening, at least in tech, by far. And yet I wonder how many of you listening right now are still listening with both ears. Is it interesting to you? Do you like even thinking about it, or is it easier just to ignore? Not worry about it?
Are you asking me?
Them.
Oh.
Let us know. SU@dw.com. Most of the developed world, I would suggest that a lot of you listening right now, you're living in places where people are not having enough babies. to replace the population that naturally passes away.
Total fertility rates dropping all over the place. Replacement fertility rate. Not enough kids are being had to keep the population where it's at.
Typically, you need 2.1 children per couple to reach replacement so that the population that is there now remains there. And in many, many countries around the world, I think in nearly all or all European countries, the number is in the 1-point-something range. Populations are getting smaller. Countries are shrinking in terms of how many people yeah. live there. The question is...
Well, I know that one of our listeners, Mark, is probably cheering right now in his cabin up yeah. in northern Washington.
Yeah.
But that is a real problem for governments around the world, right?
So obviously, they're doing whatever they can. And the question is, first of all, why is this happening and what can we do about it? We're going to go now to the Max Planck Institute for Demographic Research to find out if there's an answer.
Science Unscripted.
Hello, everyone. My name is Henrik Alexander Schubert. I'm a demographer. I'm at the Max Planck Institute for Demographic Research and getting a degree in sociology from the University of Oxford.
You just published, Henrik, a paper on fertility. What was the main takeaway, the primary conclusion from that research?
Yeah, indeed. So in this paper, we investigated the relationship between human and economic development and fertility. And we found that the relationship is actually changing. So from the 70s onwards, in the beginning, it was largely negative. So increases in human development and economic output reduced fertility. But then there was reversal of this relationship and fertility started to increase with more development. But in the last 10 years, this relationship breaks.
And when you say break, if I'm following current global trends, right, it means that people's standard of living is going up, but they're having fewer and fewer babies.
Indeed. This is what we find as well for the United States. And so it seems to be either that this reversal was just temporarily or historical, or that there are other factors currently at play that are just more important and stronger.
There's a theory I've seen a lot of people kind of spout online, and it goes something like this. It's not that your country becomes economically developed. There are skyscrapers and sparkling roads and things like that that leads to a drop in fertility. It's that all you need, if you have access to condoms, to birth control, to contraceptives, fertility drops, and that just happens to kind of coincide with development. Is that true? Does your data show that that's the actual factor dropping fertility?
It's not just sufficient to have the means to control fertility. It's also important to have actually the desire to limit fertility, because it's not just about being able to control it, but also wanting to have fewer children. And these two factors need to coincide.
When I look at the list of the highest total fertility rates in the world, if you look at the top 30 nations, almost top 40 nations, they seem to all be in Africa. Do you have any idea of what's going on there? Why so many babies are being born in African countries compared to the rest of the world?
Yeah, we could capture it very well with the demographic transition theory. So when development progresses, fertility starts to decline, and the development actually took place later in Africa. So we are seeing declining fertility rates there as well, but we are just at an earlier stage.
If you were Chancellor of Germany, or the let's say the head of the EU Commission, or the President of the United States, or name whatever country that has seen a decline in fertility in birth rates, what would you do immediately if the goal was to, you know, have a larger population? What would you do?
So, I mean, I wouldn't persuade people to get children, because we are in a free country. Everyone can decide whether they want a child or how many. But there's still some costs involved. We could try to relieve from the parents. And these are related to housing markets, childcare facilities, and employment security. But these will work only slowly and with a certain lag. So in the short term, I would actually invest more money on the fewer children we have and really increase their productivity by boosting their education. This is probably the better economic strategy to invest in quality of children instead of quantity.
To what extent does the environment or climate change play into this? You may be able to see that in your data, in your figures as a demographer. I ask this because I've heard people say, you know, I can't bring a kid into this world. This is the planet's already overpopulated. There's too much pollution. And I'm not sure there was ever an opinion like that really in human history, not recent, where you could even think that way. Me adding one more is bad, right? Like before, adding one more was a good, universal good. You got hugs from everyone. Oh, another person on this planet. Wonderful. He or she, or they're beautiful.
Congratulations.
Yeah. And now that's a very wildly different thought, that I may be harming a damaged planet through that action. Is that reflected in any way in the data that you can see?
It is somehow a mystery. So in 2010, fertility rates declined in the US and in the Nordic countries, and we didn't expect that at all. We were caught by surprise because in the Nordic countries, so Sweden and Finland, we assumed that the generous family policies, the money transfers, the infrastructure would support them sufficiently to get children, but it still declined. And since then, we're trying to solve this puzzle, and we're proposing different explanations, and not a single one seems to explain the major fraction. So I think the major takeaway should be it's probably that multiple factors are interacting and involved at the same time. So therefore, not a single shotgun policy is out there to address it. More holistic approach, and probably just expecting smaller cohorts and fewer children in the future should be the better way out of this situation.
And that was Henrik Schubert talking to us from the Max Planck Institute for Demographic Research. And one thing I should add, Gabe, you had to leave, but I do think this is pertinent. He is going to be a father.
Really?
Yeah. He's going to be a father. He said...
Congrats, Henrik.
Yeah. He said that it was for him fundamentally connected to job security. Once he had a feeling of job security, that he was ready to make that step or take that step.
What would be the steps for you guys out there if you are considering having a child at this particular juncture in time? What has to be there as a prerequisite before you say yes to that question?
Or even if it's not you, I'm just interested in if you're looking around, and Gabe, you and I work with a lot of young people here. I don't know. If someone was like, hey, I'll pay you 100 euros to go convince that person to have a baby, it's a tough sell at the moment. Do you have any ideas, or do you not care, or even think, great, you know, let's let the population shrink out there, because we sure got a lot of people on this earth. That's also fine.
Again, Mark is jumping up and down. He's doing cartwheels.
Cartwheels. Somersaults. Let us know, su@dw.com.
Science Unscripted.
DW, made for minds.